When Leonard Bernstein's musical Candide premiered on Broadway in 1956, it won critical acclaim but was a commercial flop. In the years since, it's been tweaked and rewritten and has become a beloved piece of Bernstein's legacy. Audiences relate to the naive Candide who strives mightily to find the good in life despite tragedy all around him.
And so we constantly have this activity in our head of there must be a why. Because if things are truly random, then how would we get up in the morning and feel like autonomous beings?
Today we're going to talk with Alliance Theater Artistic Director Susan Booth about the upcoming co-production of Candide she's mounting with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. And we'll look at the genius of Bernstein with the ASO's Evan Mirages.
A conductor, composer, teacher, and it was all in one terribly busy, always a day late and a dollar short human being.
Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. This year, we mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of one of America's most renowned composers, conductors, educators, and humanitarians, Leonard Bernstein. Bernstein was born on August 25, 1918. Throughout this year, orchestras and theaters in the United States and around the world will celebrate his life with performances from his vast range of work. Here in Georgia, the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra has been showcasing Bernstein throughout their current season. But for me, the most exciting tribute to Bernstein here is the unique collaboration between the Alliance Theater and the Atlanta Symphony. In May, they'll present a concert production of Bernstein's Candide. It's based on Voltaire's novella by the same name, which he published in 1759. The musical debuted in 1956 and has had a storied place in musical history ever since. We're going to talk about Candide, Bernstein, and the upcoming ASO Alliance Theater production with Alliance Theater Artistic Director Susan Booth, who's directing the show, and her ASO partner Evans Mirages, Vice President of Artistic Planning for the Symphony. But to start, I thought we should listen to a little bit about Candide from the master himself. Here's Maestro Bernstein introducing the overture to Candide to an audience in London's Barbican Center in December 1989.
My dear friends, I hear you thinking, here comes the old professor to lecture us again. But I promise to be brief and only by way of introduction. For more than 30 years, 35 years to be exact, people have asked me, why Candide? During my incredibly extensive researches for this lecture, which you are now suffering, I came across the following quite succinct summing up of the whole Voltaire-isme. Quote, Voltaire was acting as an eclectic who had synthesized the ideas of the Stoics, the Epicureans, skeptics. Oh, the hell with it. Let's play the overture.
Susan and Evans, that music is so wonderful in a way you don't want it to stop, do you, Susan?
I love it.
Two notes as we begin our conversation. One, we truncated Bernstein's remarks because the end of what he said was so funny. He really did give a short lecture to the audience at the Barbican that night about Candide, and we're going to talk about Candide here. We also should note that that performance in December of 1989 came only about 9 months before he died suddenly of a heart attack. And we'll talk about his life and career in that way. But Susan and Evans, thank you so much for being here.
Your pleasure.
Two-Way Street.
Good to be here.
Susan, let me start with you, if I may. Just the most, you know, to get us really going, what is Candide about?
You know, if you want a thorough plot synopsis of Candide, you need a much longer show. Candide is the ultimate hero's journey. It is a young man who has been cast out of what he believes was paradise, set on his own, brokenhearted, and he walks through the world and is a part of the best and worst of humanity as he tries to reunite with his lost love. And after, let's see, shipwrecks, earthquakes, auto-de-fés, the odd enslavement, a few homicides, some abductions, an old woman with one buttock who takes him under her wing, he ends up reunited with Cunegonde, the love of his life, somewhat worse for wear, but determined to live an optimistic yet realistic life.
Oh, I love that. Thank you. All of this framed by the Professor Pangloss, who has taught Candide and his other students that we live in the best of all possible worlds, that all things are for the best, and even in the midst of tragedy, if we only stood back and got the bigger picture, we'd understand that God was good and life was good. Yeah?
What I love about the original novella is that Voltaire titles it Candide or Optimism.
Yeah.
And what's telling to me is that Voltaire, who was really a fantastic bad boy of his time, Voltaire, in short order, beginning in 1749, suffered three incredible tragedies. One deeply intimate. He lost the love of his life, Madame Chatelet, who died suddenly and young. Then in 1755 came the Lisbon earthquake, in which 30,000 innocent souls perished. And then fast on the heels of that began the Seven-Year War, where countless innocents were slaughtered by one another, right? And Voltaire, after actually believing in the Leibniz, Gottfried Leibniz philosophy of the best of all possible worlds, all is for the best, couldn't believe it anymore. And on the heels of those three events, he wrote Candide.
The overall philosophy that Pangloss expresses in the face of tragedy, Evans, really is the song that we hear early in the show. Let's listen to just a little bit from the original Broadway cast of Candide, The Best of All Possible Worlds.
Let us review lesson 11,
paragraph 2, axiom 7.
Once one dismisses the rest of all possible worlds, one finds that this is the best of all possible worlds.
Once one dismisses the rest of all possible worlds, one finds that this is the best of all possible worlds.
Evans, the best of all possible worlds. As we hear that song, and as we listen to a few other selections from the show, I think it's important to point out that Bernstein wrote this as an operetta, so that it is virtually sung through, and that song and others that we'll hear make it clear you need operatic voices to sing this well.
You do and you don't.
Okay.
One of the interesting things about Candide and the progression of productions that have happened all the way up to our time is that it has been done with all Broadway singers, it's been done with all opera singers, and it's been done countless times with a mix of the two. And that's what we're doing here in Atlanta. Robert and Susan agreed that Candide and Cunegonde are the two most, as it were, operatic roles. And so we looked for that little holy grail of two young singers who could both act up a storm and sing up a storm. The thing to remember, though, which I always love recollecting about Candide, particularly since her recent passing, was that Barbara Cook, the original Cunegonde, didn't read music.
You have just given me the opportunity to play for you a little of Barbara Cook talking about coming to audition for Candide.
I didn't really give it a thought because, you know, everybody said it's got a lot of high notes. I just thought they wouldn't hire me for this. They had trouble finding somebody, evidently. When I arrived, Bernstein was not there yet, and the producer said, perhaps you'd like to look at this aria that they've written for your role, Cunegonde, while we're waiting. So it was like 15 pages in length or something like that. And I could see those lines above the staff. I don't read music. I didn't then, I don't now. But you get all those lines above the staff and you know something's going on, right? And I tell you the truth, it really relaxed me because I thought, there's no way in hell I'm going to get this.
So true.
She was told, she was asked, can you sing what a high C for, especially for a song we're going to listen to in a couple
exactly
minutes, right?
Right? But the essence of it is that Bernstein was writing for a peculiar kind of voice that we have very few of anymore, which was a whole generation of Broadway singers who they might have not trained in classical music, but let's remember that microphones weren't used into the theater until the late 1950s. So all of these wonderful Broadway singers that we remember from those original cast recordings from the 40s, let's say, you know, Oklahoma and you name it, all of the great ones, these were men and women who were trained in a particular in-between way to project, because there were no microphones, which means their voices were more trained, and to deliver first and foremost text allied to music.
So Susan, Barbara Cook talks about this song that she's presented with,
right.
Glitter and Be Gay. What's the context of why Cunegonde sings that song? And then we should point out it's really Bernstein's way of spoofing an operatic aria, right?
Glitter and Be Gay is sung by our heroine, Cunegonde, who has found herself in the somewhat challenging position of being the concubine simultaneously to two powerful men. One gets Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. One gets Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And I suppose she recovered on Sundays. The cost to her spirit was significant. But golly, if they didn't bring her some nice presents on those days to thank her for her services. And the aria is this exquisitely ironic, tongue-in-cheek look at the cost of being what a man would like you to be.
Yeah. Evans, it is a difficult song to sing, is it not?
Even for the most trained operatic singer, which leaves me gobsmacked, as our English friends would say, how Barbara Cook learned it by rote and sang it 8 times a week.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine that.
We're going to listen again. This is Barbara Cook singing a portion of Glitter and Be Gay. We're going to pick it up when she really gets to the tricky stuff. But this, again, is from the original production. Here's Barbara Cook. She won that audition. She got those high notes. And on stage, she did this.
Well, from a musical point of view, too, what you have to, it bedevils every even fine coloratura opera singers today. She's singing against another rhythm constantly, and it takes the kind of concentration that only the finest singer can manage. He loves making rhythms that may seem unmusical, but ultimately are even more musical because of the friction they create. It was one of Bernstein's signatures in everything he wrote, classical, Broadway, you name it.
This song is lovely on the ear, and it is, for my money, of any song in Candide, it requires an incredible comedian.
Is your cast all signed up and ready to go? Can you tell us about who's playing these parts, or is that something we can't do yet?
We have our cast largely signed up and ready to go.
Do you have a Kunigunda?
We do, and I'm going to let Evans tell you about her because he was given the impossible task and delivered, P.S. I said, Evans, I want this woman who satisfies every bit of your deep and needy operatic soul, but I'd like her to be as much of a comedian as Madeleine Kahn. Find me her.
And we did. I'll tell you a little inside story from the audition room. One of my favorite sopranos and soprano actresses is an American singer by the name of Alexander Shoney. I've worked with her a lot here in Atlanta and at the Cincinnati Opera, where I'm artistic director. And Alexandra looks like Kunigunda. She's a beautiful woman with a wicked twinkle in her eye. And when she came to audition, she didn't tell me until afterwards, but she wasn't 100% vocally secure. She'd had a cold, she'd had a rough airplane ride, but she was a game actress and she was going to give it a go. And I know she can sing the aria. Well, in the audition, she muffed the high note, the really high note at the very end, and she did a gesture for Robert and for Susan and myself, as if to say, well, that got her the part. Not the singing of Kunigunda, because she covered her human mistake with such a wonderful comedic flair, sending up the mistake, sending herself up, and that's who Kunigunda has to be. Our Candide is a wonderful, winsome American tenor by the name of Aaron Blake. Aaron has already made his debut at the Metropolitan Opera in Traviata. Wow. He was the star of a brand new opera that had rave reviews just now in New York called Fellow Travelers, singing all over the world. And he looks like Candide. He is the young innocent. The two of them together are of similar stature. So I think if we don't use them for Candide, we can take photos of them and make maquettes of them and put them on the top of wedding cakes.
Tell you what, let's take a short break right now, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about this joint production of Candide between the Alliance Theater and the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to Two Way Street. Welcome back to Two Way Street. We are talking today to Alliance Theater Artistic Director Susan Booth and Evans Mirages, Vice President of Artistic Planning for the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. They're working together to prepare for a production of Leonard Bernstein's musical Candide, which will open at Symphony Hall on May 9th. ASO Music Director Robert Spano will conduct the score, and Susan is directing the production. Candide premiered on Broadway in 1956. Bernstein collaborated on the show with the iconic American playwright Lillian Hellman. Bernstein and Lillian Hellman had worked together previously on an operetta called The Lark, the great Lillian Hellman, the little foxes. I mean, was an extraordinary playwright in those days.
What matters enormously about their work together and when it happened is that what they were responding to was a particular American moment. They were responding to the House Committee on Un-American Activities. They were responding to a sense of an American moment in which we were looking a little too much like fascism, where individual rights were being threatened with curtailment. And as two vividly intelligent people with deep skills, they said, we cannot stand by. We need to make work that speaks dynamically to this moment. And I'll tell you, I think it's interesting that we're doing this show in this American
moment. Talk about that a little more.
These were political artists. These were deeply talented, divinely gifted artists, but they were political artists who took the temperature of the time and said, we must address. We are in a moment right now where people are struggling with a feeling of vicissitude, a feeling of each day a new trauma, quite literally today, each day a new trauma. And how, when you are feeling as if there is a puppet master who may not have your best interests at heart, do you maintain compassion? Do you maintain optimism? It is shot through Voltaire's novella, and it is shot through Candide, the opera, the musical.
I also think that there's particularly one song in the show which is an expression of how miscommunication can take place between people that I thought, as I listened to the score again preparing for you, has relevance today. We'll listen to a little bit of it and then talk about the lyrics. But this is Candide and Cunegonde coming together. They want to marry, and they start to talk about the lives that they envision that they will have as a couple.
When we feel we can afford it, we'll build a modest little farm.
We'll buy a yacht and live aboard it, rolling in luxury and stylish charm.
Cows and chickens,
social world,
peas and cabbage,
ropes of pearls.
Soon there'll be little ones beside us. We'll have a sweet Westphalian home.
Riches Midas, we'll live in Paris when we're not in Rome.
Smiling baby,
marble halls,
Sunday picnic,
costume balls.
Ah, how we misunderstand one another.
I love the fact that a love affair that takes Candide across the globe and Cunegonde to heights and depths of human experience is founded on a complete misunderstanding of what their future is.
Tell us a little bit about why Leonard Bernstein matters as an American composer.
He is our first truly international musical ambassador. He is a protean musician in every sense of the word that could have only been, as it were, created in our country because he knew no boundaries. He didn't grow up in some sort of very hidebound Viennese tradition where you are only a performer, you're only a director, you're only a conductor. America allowed Bernstein to do something that to this day Europeans can't do, which is a composer who was as successful on Broadway as he was in the concert hall, a magnificent lecturer, as Susan already said, just an incredible mind, conductor, composer, teacher, and it was all in one terribly busy, always a day late and a dollar short human being.
What does that mean?
He tried to do the lives of five people in one lifetime. And yes, he flamed out early. Remember, he was only in his early 70s when he died. And if you knew the Bernstein of the last decade of his life, you saw the physical toll of a life lived to the brim, and as Victor Borgo once said about a rather large operatic soprano, she not only filled the part, she overflowed it a little bit.
This is a man who wrote a couple of operas. He wrote choral pieces. He wrote masses. He wrote musicals. He wrote operetta. He did piano pieces. I mean, he wrote a lot, but...
Not without struggle.
Not without... Okay, that
makes
sense.
But so did Beethoven, and not without struggle.
As Evan said, this was a man who was at any given time working on far more than he had the capacity to work on, right? He has a famous line that genius requires two ingredients, a wonderful idea, not quite enough time. I think Candide was something that felt essential to him. The message of Candide, once he read Voltaire's novella, he became possessed by it and had such a lovely time working with Lillian Hellman. He thought, this is the way to go. But if you look at the litany of collaborators on this piece over its evolution, And that's not done yet, right? People are still adapting Candide, right? It was a grand idea in search of the right collaborators.
In fact, you already mentioned that Lillian Hellman was the first one to come in and write the book. They got help then from Dorothy Parker, the great Dorothy Parker.
From the poet Richard Wilbur.
I think Stephen Sondheim had a little bit of a hand in this contributed. At one point.
Hugh Wheeler. There have been Lonnie Price, who's a currently working Broadway director, contributed to the concert staging libretto that we're going to be using in Atlanta. It's an all skate.
Susan, you have a challenge here because you're not on the Alliance stage. You're on the stage of Symphony Hall, which only has a certain amount of depth. So even if you were dying to do it, you really don't have the room to do a full-blown staged production of Candide. But you found some really creative ways to do what's a concert production, a fair way to describe it?
It is a concert production, but I was so informed by this wonderfully ludicrous odyssey that Pangloss and Candide take. And how could we, in some measure, introduce the audience to shipwrecks, to volcanoes, to auto-de-fés? What we're going to have is what's referred to as toy theater. And on a live feed camera in Symphony Hall, we are going to have every moment of this odyssey play out with figures smaller than your hand. So the notion, it was twofold. It was about not having quite the square footage to do a full-scale production, but also, if you go back to Voltaire, he talks about God as a kind of ill-tempered marionettist. And this notion of being controlled by some larger being who is sometimes interested and sometimes disinterested in our outcomes, which felt like a fantastic visual metaphor for puppetry.
Hmm. How do you approach a show on this scale?
I get to play, and I mean that not in the symphonic way, but in the creative way, in the completely childlike way. I get to play with Robert Spano. And as soon as we started talking about this project, he made it absolutely clear that I should not feel as if there were a extant protocol within which I needed to work. I said to him with absolute fear and loathing that I was outing myself as a complete idiot about choral music. I said, would it be possible in this one number if the entire musical moment pulled up short? There is a moment in The Best of All Possible Worlds, which you played for us earlier, where Candide is trying to understand how this philosophy works in times of particular human crisis. And what Candide asks Pangloss, his teacher, is what about war?
What about war? War. The war may seem a bloody curse. It is a blessing in reverse. When cannons roar, both rich and poor, by danger are united.
Till every wrong is righted. Philosophers make evidence.
Rather a large idea, that. How do you reconcile that everything in the world is for the best amidst times of war? And I want to punctuate that. I want to draw a hard frame around that. And so I asked Robert, thinking, here it goes. He's going to roll his eyes. Would it be possible if everything stopped, full orchestra, full chorus, if everything stopped at that moment? And he clapped his hands together and said, delightful.
Well, what your listeners probably know from other programs in this series and the collaborations that Robert has done, Robert has worked extensively with GLOW, the wonderful contemporary dance company here in Atlanta. And he's been on a platform playing the piano, being spun around. He's danced. He's been dragged across the stage of Symphony Hall. Robert's up for anything that has artistic validity. And then some.
We'll take another break right now. But when we come back, we'll have more with Susan Booth and Evans Mirages about the Atlanta Symphony Alliance Theater joint production of Candide. If you're just joining us, my guests on Two Way Street are Evans Mirages of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra and Susan Booth, Artistic Director of the Alliance Theater. We're talking about their upcoming joint production of one of the most fabled musicals in Broadway history, Leonard Bernstein's Candide. Susan is directing the show. ASO music director Robert Spano will conduct. Their production is being mounted as part of a worldwide celebration of the 100th anniversary of Bernstein's birth. Let's talk more about the arc of the show, the story. You've already, Susan, we know that from the very beginning, we're told Pangloss lectures that everything is the best in the best of all possible worlds. And given that philosophy, Candide goes out to face the world with expectations of accomplishing anything he wants. And of course, is met with one tragic incident after another. And as we've kind of already made clear, Voltaire was drawing in his novella in real life. He was drawing on the horrendous Lisbon earthquake. He was drawing on the Spanish Inquisition. So Candide has to figure out how do all these tragedies fit into what Pangloss has taught
me. And no need for spoiler alert here. He's remarkably good at it, right? Candide is our voice and presence in the story. And he does what we do, which is to rationalize and justify and say, I'm going to find an explanation for this. We're brains on legs. That's what we are. And so we constantly have this activity in our head of there must be a why. Because if things are truly random, if there truly is not a path, then how would we get up in the morning and feel like autonomous beings?
And that's what Candide sings to try to explain all this to himself.
My world is dust now, and all I loved is dead. Oh, let me trust now in what my master said. Is a sweetness in every woe. It must be so, it must be so.
Oh, wow. That is gorgeous.
It just reminds me that there's a style of Bernstein which I've come to call the simple song style. And Bernstein is at his greatest sometimes when he is being the least pretentious. And he has this dialogue with his creator, which is sometimes querulous, as in the Kaddish Symphony. And he has this ability, however, to create a total stillness and awe. That's the most simple accompaniment. That's sustaining strings and a harp and a singer, singing again, intervals you don't expect, but it always draws you right into the heart because it is almost like a prayer.
Well, I suppose you could say, you tell me, that a year later, Broadway audiences heard that again when Tony sings Maria in
Same
West
thing.
Side Story.
It's that still moment that he alone of our American Broadway music or classical music composers commanded in Excelsis. When he found that he could, the moment did not require him to be clever or referential of any other composer, but that's the true heart of Leonard Bernstein.
So, Susan, Candide and Cunegonde are thrown into these horrendous circumstances. They continue to believe in their master. But, Susan, they haven't found peace, and they certainly haven't found that everything is for the best in this best of all possible worlds.
And ultimately, there is a... what I find one of the most moving works of music theater ever conceived, which is Make Our Garden Grow.
So tell us about the song.
So our disparate folks have all reunited Candide, Cunegonde, Pangloss, perhaps just a tiny bit wiser, somewhat battered. They're on a small farm in Constantinople. And they realize that the one thing they can do is a very simple thing. They can make a garden. And what's interesting to me about that moment is that Pearl Clegg, who's a writer we love to work with at the Alliance, who I think is in her way a kind of griot, she seems to understand the world before the rest of us, she wrote a new play that we're doing just a few months before Candide this past year. It's called Pointing at the Moon. And there is a monologue in it about a woman who's gone through some significant challenges, who talks about growing tomatoes and the healing she finds in her garden and in that moment when she takes a perfectly ripe tomato and leans over the sink and takes a bite. And it's fascinating to me that this piece that began in the 50s and Pearl's piece, which began a year ago, come to the same arrival point. Sometimes we simply must work with our hands, shoulder to shoulder with those we love, and do the simple things and take solace in that.
In the novella, Voltaire points us to the song that we're going to listen to and to what you said. Pangloss says to Candide, there's a concantation of events in this best of all possible worlds. For if you had not been kicked out of a magnificent castle for love of Miss Cunegonde, if you had not been put into the Inquisition, if you had not walked over America, he makes the case for this is the best of all possible worlds. And Candide very simply in the last line of the book responds, all that is very well, but let us cultivate our garden.
If you've done your work correctly, you arrive at this moment fully appraised of misunderstandings, of the complete lack of control and agency we have in our lives, no matter how smart we are. And yet, we retain this flicker of hope and this fertile belief that if we just take one step at a time in the company of our fellows, we'll be okay.
The finale, Evans, is this gorgeous song. And this is one of his true masterpieces, this song.
And what it does is what all great operatic ensembles do. It takes a melody that you think is the principal melody, but each character in their own way is expressing their particular individual emotion, but they all feed into the one larger emotion. And that's one thing that music theater can do that even film can't do, that a book can't do, that even a play can't do, because people talking over one another, you'll never understand it. It'll sound like a garbled mess. But if you put it to music, you will be able to pick out different sentiments, different tone colors as the piece is going by, and you will have a richer experience and you will understand at a greater and deeper level of the varying sentiments that are going on all at once.
No, we won't think noble because we're not noble. We won't live in beautiful harmony because there's no such thing in this world, nor should there be. We promise only to do our best and live out our lives. Dear God, that's all we can promise in truth. Marry me, Cunegonde.
So have I, but come and be my wife, and let us try before we die to make some sense of life. Chop our wood and make our garden grow and make our garden grow.
This is a piece I encountered when I was, golly, about 20 years old. I was in a college production of Candide. And I didn't fully understand or appreciate what led up to the final moment. And it was the first time as a performer that I'd ever found myself overwhelmed. And as one of those many voices in that final number, I was overwhelmed. And Evans knows this. There is a physiological effect of certain construct of music that suspends the frontal lobe and puts us in a different state. And I went there every night, and I have never forgotten this piece's capacity to do that.
Leonard Bernstein died way too young, October of 1990. He died of a heart attack. He had progressive emphysema. He had pulmonary problems. He smoked cigarettes to the bitter end. In fact, there's a story about the fact that at Alan J. Lerner's funeral, another one of the great Broadway songwriters, fans of Bernstein's who gathered to watch the funeral, people coming to the funeral, held up a poster that essentially read, "We love you, stop smoking." And this was a few years before he eventually died.
The last summer of his life, which he didn't expect to be the last summer of his life, but he had a fatalism about him. He was conducting at his beloved Tanglewood, and I was the artistic administrator of the Boston Symphony. And during a very, very difficult set of rehearsals for what became his final concert of his life, I had to go into his dressing room and talk to him and ask if he would relinquish part of the program to the assistant conductor of the orchestra because he was clearly struggling. And Bernstein wanted to, as Orlando Di Lasso used to say in his wonderful madrigal, "My End is My Beginning," I think he knew that his life needed to end as an artist at Tanglewood if it had to end. So I went into his dressing room, and there he was. There was a massage table on the corner because he also had an enormous tumor of the lung that he didn't talk about at the time, and had an oxygen tank, a bottle of scotch, and a lit cigarette in a tray. He could have blown Tanglewood sky high, but even though he was near dying and struggling to make one last concert, that cigarette was still there next to the Ballantines. But that was Bernstein too. He simply accepted no limits on anything, and he was probably most unbelieving in his moment of death, saying, "Already?"
Evan Mirage's Susan Booth, this production of Candide coming up. What a great way to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Leonard Bernstein's birth. Susan and Evans, thank you so much for coming in to talk about Candide today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
The Alliance Theater Atlanta Symphony co-production of Candide opens in Atlanta's Symphony Hall on May 9th and runs through May 20th. We posted information about tickets on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. Many people in my generation were first introduced to Leonard Bernstein through a TV show that aired on the CBS television network.
Carnegie Hall in New York City, the home of the world's greatest musical events. Today's event is one in a series of New York Philharmonic Young People's Concerts, under the musical direction of Leonard Bernstein.
In each episode of that show from 1962 to 1972, Bernstein talked with an audience of New York City school kids about basic musical concepts like, what's a concerto? How do you define classical music? And he introduced his audiences to composers as varied as Gustav Mahler, Aaron Copland, and Shostakovich. On the show we're going to hear a bit from now, he led an exploration of why Rossini's famous William Tell Overture feels so exciting.
Ready? Go! Tick-a-dum, 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 bum-bum! You see how exciting that last phrase is? It has all the excitement and triumph of winning an argument. It makes you feel good. But there are still more reasons why this music is exciting. For instance, the way it's played, the instruments that play it, like those trumpets at the beginning. Or the violins, who use their bows in a jumping way to make that galloping sound. Would you show us, Mr. Corigliano? You see? Now, when all the strings do that together, it really gallops. Watch. So you see, this music is exciting because it was written to be exciting.
The program showed Bernstein at his best. He was charming, knew how to talk about music in a way that's easily relatable, and yes, we see just what a ham he was in craving attention. As we celebrate the 100th anniversary of his birth this year, Leonard Bernstein continues to be remembered as one of the most important forces in the history of American music. As we leave you today, let's listen to more of the majestic finale to Bernstein's Candide. About out of time for today's show, but I want to remind you that if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can still listen by subscribing to the Two Way Street podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. All of our shows are archived on our website at gpb.org/TWS. That's a good way to catch up on some of the programs you may have missed. Our conversation with astronaut Scott Kelly, for instance, who shared with us his experiences of spending a year living on the International Space Station. Or the program we did with Lynn Rosetto Casper, who just retired after 2 decades hosting The Splendid Table. She talks with us about her life in food, as well as her secret desire to become a Broadway actress. You can also listen to our conversation with one of America's most prolific and successful songwriters, Jimmy Webb. He told us what inspired him to write some of his biggest hits, songs like By the Time I Get to Phoenix, Wichita Lineman, MacArthur Park, and many others. That's the Two-Way Street Archive at gpb.org/TWS.